This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When we think of terrorism, you might think of drones or suicide bombers and some other technologically advanced form of weaponry. But terrorism was born long before these technologies existed, and it's been used in a lot of different contexts, including America's Indian Removal Project and the lynching culture in the American South. Martin A. Miller is a professor at Duke in the Department of History and the Department of Slavic and Eurasian Studies, and he has a new book called The Foundations of Modern Terrorism. He's with us here today. Martin Miller, welcome to the State of Things.
Good Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
So I define terrorism as when people do bad things to me, but I'm guessing you have a broader definition of that.
Yes, somewhat.
Good.
Indeed, although
Good.
Certainly that's included.
Yeah.
There are a number of, I think, characteristics that usually show up. First of all, the kind of terrorism that I'm talking about is political. That's an important part of it. That rules out a whole bunch of terrorisms that are terrible things and awful things that happen to humanity. So that's one part of it. The other part of it has to be repeated, because if it happens once and we know it won't happen again, we're not going to be afraid. The other thing is that I believe that it, and I think this is an important point, that there's a conjunction for it to function between two parties. And I think these two parties are all present. And I think that's one of the things I've tried to do in the book, is to show historically how both the forces within the state and forces within the insurgencies in society have acted together to create terrorist moments.
So that's interesting. The terrorist who has a political agenda uses fear as one of the tools, you're saying, can't really operate effectively unless the counterpart somehow acknowledges that and plays along.
Right. That is, if there's, as I say in the book, if there's an advancing of the conversation that I've made, it's to bring these two parties together into the open rather than having them dealt with separately, which is what historians and commentators, I think, have done until now.
Well, but let me ask it this way. I mean, is there a way to ignore terrorism? If somebody sets off bombs in your trash cans, or if they blow up your buildings, I mean, we have to engage them then.
Oh, there's
we?
No doubt about that. The only question is how to engage them, and at what point in the process of the forces being locked into combat are we entering the scene? If it is ongoing, then you need a very different kind of strategy to deal with it than you do if, in fact, you're on top of the situation while it's growing and while it's developing.
So in a sense, I mean, there's one way to deal with the terrorist organization, and that is to say, we will, as the state, in your name, protect you from this. We're going to stop them from committing violence, which means we may have to use the same kind of violence in return. Another approach might be to say, well, I don't like the way they went about this, but, you know, they just might have a point. Let's see if we address some of that and not directly engage their violence and see if that doesn't put an end to what they're up to.
That's good, and that's one of the things I think that we don't do as often as we ought to. The point about who is good and who is evil is also complicated here, as you've mentioned yourself, because very often the people who we think are protecting us are actually the provocateurs of the very problem itself. It's happened too often.
And they're in a position of being a state entity, a well-recognized institution. So that leads to the question of whether terrorism or the terrorist has to be a non-state entity, and whether states can, by definition, engage in terrorism.
It's a conundrum and a problem, and it's also difficult because most people in most countries don't want to admit that their own governments are operating this way. So I think one is up against a kind of a wall all the time. It's kind of a cultural problem. However, I'm convinced on the basis of the evidence that I've brought to bear in many parts of the world in this book over a couple of hundred years that this is indeed the case. It's very often, it's like the lawyer who says, trust me, I'll protect you, but in fact isn't able to. In this case, the person who you are trusting, as I said before, maybe not only the provocateur, but also, and there are numerous instances of this, maybe, in fact, one of the agents of violence. That's the hardest thing, I think, for us to grapple with.
What do you mean?
I mean that it's easy for, well, as one of my students said, we are the children of 9/11, and so I can't understand this problem of terrorism other than as an insurgent one. And I respect that, and I understand that. However, the problem really is that's only one half of the problem. It's much deeper than that. And what I'm saying is that agents of violence in governments here and there have at different time periods engaged in pretty much the same violence, the same kind of terrorisms that they claim to be fighting using what are, as you referred to correctly before, counterinsurgency measures.
So let's just take examples. The United States of America now engaged in a war on terror. They are doing bad things to us. We'd like to make that all stop. And yet we certainly used violence in what we glibly called our manifest destiny, didn't we?
Yes. And that takes us back well into the 90s, if not before, to try and understand how it was that the global battlefield became precisely that, one of terrorism, which we became engulfed by.
Well, and I'm also referring to the winning of the West, the fact that the Indian removal project, which we termed our manifest destiny to get to the West Coast, involved terrorism. It involved holding populations of native camps and people hostage to the idea that they would either die or move.
Yes. Democratic terrorism is again, one of the more difficult problems to deal with. Mainly because I think most of us really don't want to think of things that way. But yes, the Indian Removal Act was, I mean, that whole story has not been told in terms of terrorism until quite recently. It's, I don't know where you went to high school, but I know my education was quite different. I didn't.
No, we didn't use the term genocide either, although
no.
I don't know how it doesn't apply.
Right. But the evidence is extraordinarily clear, and I've got passages in the book, I think, that make this entirely clear, that this was a savage state run exit of an entire population. I hesitate to use the term genocide because I don't think that was the purpose of the United States government, but removal and exile is really the better term.
Under pain of death, and I think that's part of it. And also, you have to talk about lynching in the American South as a form of terrorism.
Yes, and that too is quite recent. One doesn't go back too far in the histories of that whole subject before you run into it being called all sorts of other things other than terrorism. Yes, this is something I think that really we ought to devote more attention to. It gets easier the more distance that passes between the actual events themselves, but the problems remain with us to this day, which of course are all about racism. The thing that's peculiarly American, there's only one other instance of this I know, and that took place in Russia in a very small number of years with the pogroms against the Jews. But the situation in this country, well over a century of public lynchings, murders of people, most of whom were entirely innocent of the charges themselves, celebrated with banquets and festivals and barbecues afterwards, all of it printed, or most of it printed in the press the next day. The public record is full of it. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, and I think it's fair to say the pogroms were carried out over much of Eastern Europe and over a period of decades at the end of the 19th and early 20th century.
Right, right. I was just speaking specifically of this unusual engagement of state, local authorities, and the population, all which come together united against a population that they feel threatens them, and they must be eliminated with violence.
Let's talk about the origins of this, because I think there's also a feeling that the idea of terrorism, political violence, has always been with us as long as there have been human societies. But you really dated the modern terrorist movement or modern terrorism to the French Revolution. Talk about that.
Yes, that's a really important watershed for me. I think that the best way to understand it, and perhaps the simplest way to understand it, is it was a crucial moment in establishing the first democratic republic in the history of Europe. And what that meant was that anybody, you or me, sitting in the parliament in 1789, had as much right as anybody else to decide the destiny of the country. We were now empowered. That means that you have a plethora of possibilities. Just a quick anecdote, the word legitimacy, which is really what much of the terrorism has always been about, was a word that was used in the singular prior to the French Revolution. In European dictionaries, legitimacy is a single word, singular word. It becomes plural only after 1789 because there are now legitimacies to choose from. Those people who are siphoned off because of their extraordinary desire to transform the world in an image that they have and are willing to use violence, they are the terrorists.
And so the point is, if we democratize the society and the decision-making, then we have to use political violence, if that's what we resort to, against a much larger population. It's not just a king and a few of his knights.
That's right. That's right. The battlefield becomes much wider, and that's why it's become such an incredible problem for us to deal with in the 21st century.
And interestingly enough, if you get back to this to lynching, it derives its name from a Revolutionary War officer. So again, maybe you can talk about that, but this idea of democracy, democratizing the polity, and then using violence against everybody, work hand in hand. They're born together.
It's, again, a difficult problem to deal with, but you've got it. I mean, I think that one of the unfortunate features of the rise of democracies, and we find this wherever we further them around the world, is the possibility that more and more people have the right to assert their political perspective. And that means that some of those people are going to be willing to use violence. So, yes, it's a very unfortunate consequence of the democratic process.
To what extent do power equations and broad and huge power imbalances provoke terrorism? If you aren't a player in the nuclear game, then you don't have much at your disposal if you want to force an outcome.
Yes, right. I think that, I mean, and again, looking at this over the long range historically, it almost doesn't matter what the weaponry is. It's just that it's become now so much more terrifying in terms of the casualty lists. What I think lies behind some of this tension is the insecurity over governance. If people are satisfied with their government, and if the administration in government is pretty secure, there's much less reason, and those are the instances in which you don't have terrorist moments, as I call them. That's why it's a specificity that we're talking about. A number of conditions have to come together. As I say in the book, there are no terrorist states, but there are terrorist moments and states of terror.
Well, do states have to act in two minds? I mean, on the one hand, if you're the United States of America and you find yourself under a terrorist threat that is smaller units, less well organized, and in fact, entities against which nuclear weapons are completely useless because there's no state, there's no target, do you have to act on the one hand publicly at home talking about your military strength, bringing all that to bear, and then recognizing that that's not effective against this force and almost engaging the terrorists on their own terms using their tactics, terrorism?
Well, I think that's the dangerous process that we tend to get into. If I had to talk about ways out, I would talk about words instead of deeds. I would talk about negotiations with the enemy, which is not something that's easy to do, and I don't know that there would be positive outcomes. I can give you one quick example. Historically, there was a war against anarchism at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries, proclaimed by a number of leaders in Europe, and the United States joined in once President McKinley was assassinated in 1901. There were international conferences held in The Hague and St. Petersburg. It all failed. The anarchist peril, such as it was, disappeared for entirely other reasons, not because of the government's repression, although they tried hard. So making war, I think, is not the solution.
But if you talk, I mean, the danger is, and the argument against negotiation is that the terrorists have already won once you begin to negotiate. You by sitting down at the table, have recognized their legitimacy, which is something we're loath to do because of their tactics.
It depends, again, who one is talking about. My model for solutions is Ireland, and I don't know whether that applies to all the situations that we are confronted with right now in 2013, but it worked. The Accords are still holding since 1998. The savagery of the Troubles, as the Irish have always referred to them, has largely ended. There are, of course, incidents here and there. So I think that's one model of the alternative to going into combat.
Clearly, the IRA considered a terrorist organization, committing terrorist acts to get its way politically, and now has a place at the table after negotiations.
And recognizing that the British committed acts of terrorism and that the Ulster paramilitary groups also were involved in terrorism. All of them were committing acts of violence. The other alternative, the only other one that's really out there, are the Truth and Reconciliation Commission efforts that were begun in South Africa. Again, there are instances where this could be tried or where we haven't even attempted to. But you need to have people willing to talk.
Well, and again, you can argue that the ANC, while nominally a nonviolent institution, certainly used violence and certainly used terrorist tactics, whether or not Nelson Mandela would have approved, and again, now had a place at the table and ultimately achieved their ends.
Right.
Are there other examples? I mean, the larger question, does terrorism work? How effective is it, whether we like it or not?
I think it fails all the time. The only question is how much damage does it managed to accomplish before its demise. There is no example of any kind of permanent terrorist anything, either an insurgency or a state. And the most horrifying examples that we have, Nazi Germany, Stalin's Russia, everything ceases to exist at some point in terms of the violence for different reasons. But the other part that might be worth mentioning is also that the nature of the enemy, first of all, that states have committed more atrocities and more deaths exponentially than all of the insurgent groups added up throughout the last 200 years. There's no question about that. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that the enemies may not always be real. They may be imaginary. They need to be there. So what I'm saying is that my famous example is Stalin's fear of poets, who he rounded up and sometimes sent to the Gulag to be tortured and killed.
It should have been just bad poets.
Yeah, right. Or a stable ruler who needn't fear poets.
Right, right. And that's part of the other, I mean, that's the other side of the picture. We think of terrorists, particularly when they're aiming their weapons at us, as truly representing the people who they say they're speaking for. And yet we know that often they've taken power, perhaps over and against the better judgment of the... And in a sense, hold their own people or those for whom they nominally speak hostage to the same kind of terror. Just dare replace us as your spokesman. And that goes for Muslim terrorists as well as the United States, which has an ongoing war against terror and keeps us in a high state of anxiety and reluctant to push back when even our civil liberties are eroded.
Quite right. And it's a real fear. There are numerous examples. I mean, the Algerian War is one that people bring up all the time. Violence didn't end once the French were expelled. So, yes, and there are cases of outlaw regimes coming to power. Hitler, after all, was elected to power. Others seized power, like London. But these people lived in the underground. And another important component that we need to keep in mind here is the secrecy and the language, the coded language that people involved in violence use. And the way they see the world is composed of that kind of vocabulary. And it's very difficult to break through that. One should try, but it's very difficult.
Particularly, as you suggest in this book and point out very clearly, that when you engage them on their own terms, that, by its very nature, gives validity to the language, to the architecture, and to the frame in which they're seeing the world. And so that forces us to see the world the way they do.
That is true. But at the same time, what gets revealed very often are the very things that are being hidden. For example, the role that governments have played in creating the situations of violence, which are kept entirely secret. We know less about that than we know lots about the insurgency.
For example. A revelation of that sort.
Oh, there are tons of them. I'll give you one, not from the United States at the moment. A more graphic one is the case in Russia. This took place during the upheaval around the 1905 revolution in Russia when an insurgent member of the Socialist Revolutionary Party was tasked to take out the prime minister of the country. His choice was to say no and blow his cover or do it. And risk being roasted by his employer, who was the government, because he was a double agent. And he carried out his deed. He had to actually assassinate. And there are numerous examples of the other side, where the police are actually fomenting. There are lots of examples in the 60s about Black Panthers who were being provoked into the very things that the government could then charge them with.
Martin, what a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Frank.
Martin Miller, professor at Duke in the Department of History and Slavic and Eurasian Languages. His new book is called The Foundations of Modern Terrorism. And we'll look at the new American Revolution when our program continues. Stay tuned.